The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And we are joined tonight by Andrew Collins. How you doing, Andrew?
I'm fine. How are you?
All right. And you've been doing a lot of research for your new book, haven't you?
I have, yeah. It seems to be like an ongoing project, which has been going on for years and doesn't seem to stop. And even though the book's with the publishers awaiting its publication now, I'm still finding out new material virtually every week. And it's an exciting subject which is evolving, you know, constantly. It's incredible.
And the new book is on Göbekli Tepe primarily, correct?
Yes, it's called The Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods. And it's out early next year through Bear & Company in the United States. It should also be available elsewhere as well. As the title says, the first half of the book is solely about Göbekli Tepe, but the second half of the book is the search for Eden, the earthly paradise, and its association with the angels and the watchers, and the Book of Enoch and the Anunnaki, and trying to put all of this together for the first time. And what I am able to show, I believe, is that the mythical beings that are remembered as the Watchers and the Anunnaki were responsible for the construction of Göbekli Tepe. And although this might sound very controversial, it's actually not, because the lead archaeologist working on the site, Dr. Klaus Schmidt, a very forward-thinking German archaeologist, has even linked the Watchers and the Anunnaki with the builders of Göbekli Tepe. So, you know, this is not some weird New Age alternative historian idea. This is now mainstream.
All right. And for people who don't know what Göbekli Tepe is, we talked about it a little last time you were on, but do you want to give some people just a brief overview of it?
Yeah, I can. Well, if you can imagine a mountaintop in southeast Turkey, not very high, only about 750 meters tall, which is, I don't know how many feet these days. And on the top of there, you have this huge artificial mound of earth and debris that stretches for, you know, hundreds of yards in every direction. And beneath this, within it, are these stone sanctuaries, these stone circles, and different monuments that have been there for at least 11,000 years and were constructed by a supposed hunter-gatherer society who came to this spot to create this for God knows what, essentially. And of course, that's the big mystery of what were these people doing, creating the first, what they call monumental architecture in human history. It's the oldest accepted human temple structures, circular and rectilinear monuments anywhere in the world. I mean, that's not to necessarily say that it is the oldest, but it's the oldest accepted monument architecture of this description. And I mean, it's exciting everybody, because everybody wants to know whether this is a remnant of a lost civilization, you know, why it was constructed, who it was constructed by, whether it was by some kind of elite that may have come into the area and taken over the show, or whether it was purely constructed by the local people for their own reasons, you know, and how it relates to what's known as the Neolithic Revolution. This is the great transition from hunter-gathering, which is essentially a lifestyle of going out on the chase, following the herds of animals, killing them, bringing them back to your family and your extended family group, and keeping them, you know, happy, keeping yourself happy over a year, to suddenly everybody working together, hundreds if not thousands of people working together to create monuments that include monoliths as much as 50 tons apiece, that in height are 7 meters, which is 22 feet in height. This is incredible. What the hell were these people doing? What were they thinking to put all this together? That's the big mystery. And to show how much of a mystery it is, the conference that we are doing in London in November, no less than 3 of the lectures, myself, Graham Hancock, and Hugh Newman, will all be featuring Göbekli Tepe to some degree, because it's a game changer. It changes everything. It makes us want to look at everything, these ancient monuments, the megalithic monuments that are in Peru, Bolivia, in Malta, in Egypt, in Britain, in Europe, in Indonesia, and say, are they part of the same culture? Are they a remnant of some kind of global civilization that existed, that somehow survived through the end of the last ice age, through what almost certainly was some kind of cataclysm that took place around that time, caused by a comet impact? That's what the scientists are telling us now. And that is this the renaissance, the resurrection of something that existed before this time? In other words, Stonehenge, Avebury, Karnak, even the Great Pyramids and the other monuments, are they in some way related to a lost civilization that pre-existed this cataclysm, that pre-existed the remnants of this last ice age, and that is something which we haven't realized? It's there amongst us, it's there with us all the time, and we're only now realizing its significance to civilization.
Okay, and how was it discovered?
Well, it's interesting, because the first people that went there in 1963. It was a small team from the University of Chicago, excuse me, and they found lots and lots of megalithic flint there, but they also found these carved stone fragments, and so sophisticated were they that they believed that they were no more than about 1,000 years old and belonged to a cemetery that had been created by the Byzantine peoples, you know, those that followed the Roman Empire, you know, mostly under Christian auspices. And that's as far as it went until 1994, when this German archaeologist, Klaus Schmidt, having seen this report, which was only published in 1980, thought, hold on, I think I might recognize what's going on here, because he'd been working in the region anyway, looking at other early Neolithic sites. And he went there and immediately realized that there was something incredible here to be discovered. And within a couple of years, they started to excavate and were finding these amazing sanctuaries, which were like stone circles, like at places like Stonehenge. But instead of the stones being sort of facing the center, the edges were turned towards the center. And many of the stones had their heads carved into a T-shaped termination. And also many of the stones had carvings of creatures of the natural world. For instance, lions, snakes, boars, cranes, different types of birds, foxes, lots of foxes, and many, many other types, arachnids, scorpions, most of them quite fierce animals. Yeah, not the sort of animals that you want to be locked up in a small room with. And I think that this was part of the fact that you're dealing here with a hunter-gathering society whose main emphasis of life is survival, and on a daily basis. And whatever the rituals that the shamans, the priests, the people carried out here, it had something to do with a reflection of their natural world. But that's all very well, but people have been doing similar rituals all the way around the world for, you know, since Paleolithic times, you know, for 10, 20, 30,000 years. So why the necessity to construct these extraordinary stone circles, of which the oldest are the most impressive? And as they gradually, you know, I say evolve, it's devolve, they get smaller and smaller, the carving gets less and less, the T-shapes eventually disappear, until you've only got really bathroom-sized sanctuaries with little tiny stones, with barely any carving. And yet somehow this was the beginning of the megalithic culture that we know, the one that eventually rises again to create monuments like Avebury and Stonehenge, and dolmens and stone circles and passage graves all the way around the world, in virtually every country of the world. So the beginnings of all of that took place in southeast Turkey at Göbekli Tepe and one or two outlying sites in that same area.
All right, and obviously there's some comparison to Stonehenge, but compared to Stonehenge, these monuments, although big, are thinner and more intricately carved, aren't they?
They're more intricately carved, but many of the stones are actually larger than Stonehenge. I mean, the in the center of the stone circles are twin monoliths, looking very similar to each other in size. They've got carvings on them. Often they've got on the inside of them, facing towards the person entering into them, you've got these huge carved foxes. On some of them, you've got lions. And these are regularly around 5.5 meters. That's about 21 feet tall, and around 15 tons apiece. And I mean, that's essentially larger than those at Stonehenge, or some of the ones at least that are used there. So we're dealing with a much larger complex than Stonehenge.
Okay, and there's one unfinished stone that's bigger than anything
we
found.
Yeah, well, that's the one that's 50 tons, according to estimates, and is 22 feet long, 7 meters long. And that's in a quarry on the top of the mountaintop, about 3/4 of a mile away from the main occupational mound, as they call it. And clearly this fractured as they were trying to get it out, so they left it there. But it does suggest that with beneath the earth that's still being excavated now, there could be pillars, or monoliths really, we should say, that are of that size. You know, so in other words, even larger than the ones that they've still found erected at this time.
And how much of Göbekli Tepe has actually been excavated at this point?
Well, at the moment, there are four major sanctuaries that have been exposed. They call them enclosures A, B, C, and D. Now, they reckon that at least another 15 to 20 similar enclosures await discovery. And some estimates even suggest there might be as many as 50, which is extraordinary. I mean, there's no question that this was a major sanctuary in the ancient world, and that people would have come here for, you know, across hundreds, if not thousands of miles. Now, why they would have come here is a mystery. But I think that what you have to take into consideration here is that this was constructed, the earliest part that's known at the moment was constructed around 9,500 BC. Now, that's within a century or so of the end of a mini ice age, which had followed the ice age proper, which is known as the Younger Dryas. Now, this lasted for around 1,200 years. And at the beginning of this, science now knows that there was a major catastrophe. It's known as the Younger Dryas boundary event, and would seem to have involved a comet fragmenting into pieces and splattering various parts of the globe, mostly in North America, although the impact of it created this cloud of dust and ash that obscured the sun for a period of time and lowered the temperatures for an extended period of time, thrusting the world into this mini ice age for about 1,200 years. And Göbekli Tepe, the earliest and the most impressive structures were created off the end of that mini ice age. There has to be a relationship, and that relationship is the fact that the construction of Göbekli Tepe is a response to what's happened. And if you can imagine that this wasn't just one comet impact, the evidence from the ice cores from Greenland would tend to suggest that there were many events going on for several hundred years after the initial one. And we're talking about extensive wildfires covering parts of the globe, possibly even another comet impact around 10,300 BC, and probably other things which we don't even yet know or understand were going on at this time. This was a terrible time to live on this earth. It was a very frightening time. And there's no question that Göbekli Tepe and probably other monuments around the world were built as a response to all of these bad things that were going on in the world. You know, and there you start to begin to understand why they're creating megalithic structures for the first time in human history.
And this site was actually intentionally buried.
Part of it was, yes.
Part of it was,
You know, I mean, each sanctuary would seem to have had a life, a period of usage. Now, it would seem that at the end of that life, which might have been, let's say, 50, 100, 150, 200 years, it was replaced by another. And some of the sanctuaries were covered over as they were going along. And the ground was leveled, and a new monument was created on the top of that. Some of the sanctuaries were left exposed for a longer period, probably because they had a different function or they were more important, may have even been the oldest ones, and they were left exposed. And gradually, over a period of 1,500 years, this occupational mound grew larger and larger and larger, with more and more of the enclosures being covered over. And then finally, around 8,000 BC, the last of the enclosures were covered and the whole place was just abandoned. New things were going on. By now you'd had the Neolithic Revolution. So people were no longer hunter-gatherers in general. They were agriculturalists. They were pastoralists. You know, they were into settled lifestyles with animal husbandry, looking after cattle and pigs and goats and things like this. Plus, they were planting. You know, they were tilling the land now. They were creating wheat and rye and barley in a much more settled agricultural lifestyle. Things had completely changed. And there's no question that places like Göbekli Tepe were responsible for this change, because they came first, and the infrastructure that built up around them necessitated another means of feeding the hundreds, if not thousands, of people who were coming here either to manufacture or construct these monuments, or coming as pilgrims from various other parts of the ancient world. And it would seem as if one of the answers that they came up with was agriculture, which they'd been experimenting with in certain parts of the world up to this time, but it was only on a very small scale. Now it was on a very wide scale. Now it was going to take over everything, because suddenly they'd realized that you didn't actually need to, you know, to hunt all the time. You could actually settle down and from year to year and rotate the crops and all this sort of stuff. So, you know, this is something which was new and something that was caused by the presence of Göbekli Tepe.
Okay, and so a lot of these ancient monuments around the world all have this thing where they seem to have the best constructed ones are the oldest.
Yeah.
Just like you're saying about Göbekli Tepe, why do you think that is?
Well, I think that obviously there was a motivation there at the beginning. Something that they felt it necessary to create monuments of such a high order. But then gradually, over a period of time, that same emphasis started to wane, started to go, and those that came after the initial peoples, although they went through the same motions, creating the same style of structures, felt that it was unnecessary to make them so large, unnecessary to decorate them so beautifully, unnecessary to create the monuments in certain, you know, patterns or something like this. In other words, they got a little bit sloppy, really. And they got away with it. The gods weren't angered, so they did it again. And I think that this is what happened at Göbekli Tepe. I think it's probably what happened in ancient Egypt with the Great Pyramid, because obviously that was the greatest of all the monuments built there. And yet the pyramids that followed, although they were incredible in design, just did not match that of the Great Pyramid, because they felt it was unnecessary to continue to build things in such a an incredible way. I think that they decided that they could get away with it by constructing other things, smaller, more symbolic, or whatever. Do you know?
Do you think that it had anything to do also with their loss of ability to move such big stones?
Yes, probably. I mean, obviously the whole Darwin idea is that we evolve, and once we learn something, we never forget it. Well, that's not true whatsoever. You know, I mean, for instance, the early Neolithic peoples that were behind Göbekli Tepe and other similar communities in that region were creating these beautiful necklaces of agate and carnelian stones, which were, some of them were up to about an inch and a half across, and they were penetrating them through longitudinally, so that they could be worn around the neck. Now, they were doing this around 8,000 BC, 7 to 8,000 BC, and then that particular ability is lost for at least 2,000 or 3,000 years and doesn't start reappearing until the emergence of the Indus Valley culture around 5,000 BC. So that's really interesting, you know, that here's an example of an ability that we have, and then it's suddenly lost. And I think that there's going to be other examples out there, possibly to do with metalwork, the use of metal. I think that at certain times in the past, we have had the ability to smelt metal, but it's been lost and not rediscovered for thousands of years later. Now, why this happens, you know, you can speculate. It could be the fact that knowledge is retained by a very small group, you know, almost in a trade secret situation. And that group might be wiped out for some reason. And they've not passed on that skill. And it is lost. It's absolutely lost. And it's the same as us. I mean, if we are suddenly thrust into some kind of cataclysm, you know, how many of us would be able to build televisions, for instance? Very few of us. And the chances are we'd lose the ability to watch television because we just wouldn't know how to construct televisions anymore. And although that's an extreme way of looking at it, that does happen, I think.
Okay. Now, we, you know, obviously you found some of the quarries that these rocks were moved from. Do we have any idea how they actually moved the rocks of these sizes? Is there any hint at all?
Not really. I mean, obviously, archaeologists, what they call experimental archaeologists, are already looking at this. But it's the usual sort of dragging it across the plain, enough people, enough rollers, enough rope, you can do it. And the chances are that, yeah, you know, that they achieved it somehow, just in the same way that they built the Great Pyramid or they built Stonehenge. And for me, that's not really my motivation of interest at Göbekli Tepe. For me, it's why they did it and who did it. You know, what was going on in the minds of these people, the mindsets of these people to create these things? That's what I'm looking at now. And what I'm increasingly finding is that these sanctuaries were, in effect, star temples. They were stargates, if you like, if you want to use a New Age term, linking the world of the living and those that died with a sky world that existed out there somewhere, and that was accessed via specially created stones that were placed within these circles that had holes in them that were what's known to archaeology today as Seelan Lock or soul holes. They were holes that allowed the souls of the dead or the unborn souls or the souls of shamans to pass through them to enter into the next world. Now, whether that next world was seen as the underworld, sky world, you know, or some other, the netherworld, or something like this, it's all essentially the same. A part of shamanic tradition is the idea that once you enter into an altered state of consciousness, you pass through some kind of hole or vortex on your journey into the next world, where you will see communications with supernatural forces, or to achieve healing or knowledge or wisdom or something, and then bring that knowledge back to the community. And there are these soul holes in the stones, in specific stones at Göbekli Tepe, and the largest and most prominent of them are situated in the north-northwest, exactly in line with the orientation of the twin central pillars of the largest of the enclosures. And it just so happens that during the time frame in question, around 9000 to 9500 BC, this was the exact setting point of a specific star, and that was Deneb, the brightest star in Cygnus, the celestial swan, which also marks the opening of what's known as the Dark Rift on the Milky Way. This is an area down the center of the Milky Way that's caused by dust and debris along the line of the galactic plane. And for us here, it looks like this dark cave-like entrance and tunnel that goes down the center of the, longitudinally, almost like a stream, dark stream down the middle of the Milky Way. And it would seem that all the way around the world, in past stages, this was seen as a entrance or exit to the other world for spirits, you know, leaving from the dead or coming back into this world to be incarnated. And it would seem as if that is what the monuments of Göbekli Tepe seem to have been aligned towards.
Okay, and there's obviously the news sites and stuff. One of the only things they've said about Göbekli Tepe is that it's aligned to Cygnus, but you've shown that that's not
Sirius. Yeah, I mean,
you're saying Cygnus, they're saying Sirius, and you've shown that that's not actually a possible alignment.
No, it's not. I mean, I'm working with a chartered engineer at the moment by the name of Rodney Hale, who I've done a lot of work with in the past, and we're also in discussion with the world's top archaeoastronomers on this subject. And although the theory was proposed by an archaeoastronomer named Giulio Magli, his theory is extremely weak, and even his colleagues do not feel that this is adequate to explain the orientations of the sanctuaries. And all the indications are that they're not facing south towards Sirius, but north towards something in that direction. And the north was the direction of the sky world, the direction of heaven, if you like, for a very long time. It's found within the Upper Paleolithic cave art of Western Europe, for instance. It's found at Avebury in England. It's found in the pyramids. It's found in India and at various other places around the world. And within Native American tradition, one of the strongest beliefs is that in death, the soul climbed the Milky Way along the Dark Rift until it reached the area of Cygnus, and was there judged by this raptor bird, and it either then was cast into oblivion or was allowed to go into the afterlife. And you find this universally around the world. So all the indications are that the shamanism that took place at Göbekli Tepe was focused upon this very same area of the sky, which seems to have been the entrance and exit to the sky world. The problem with Sirius is that at the time when Göbekli was being constructed, it was only just beginning to reappear on the southern horizon for the first time in several thousand years. And it was so weak and feeble that it was hardly visible and hardly climbed above the horizon. And I cannot see this being a reason why the people of Göbekli Tepe, the early Neolithic people, would want to orientate their monuments towards that. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
And why do you think that theory got so much news coverage?
Because it came from an academic.
Ah.
It's as simple as that. I mean, I can write volumes on the subject and will not get any publicity whatsoever. But because an academic writes it, it's got to be real.
And you've covered the Cygnus correlation in other cultures in your book, The Cygnus Mystery.
Yeah, of course. And the reason of Cygnus was because I went to Göbekli in 2004. I studied the monument there. I studied many other sites in the region, trying to look for any kind of pattern of emergence. And within a few days of returning from southeast Turkey and trying to understand the orientation of the site, I realized that they seem to be pointing towards the north, and that many other cultures that had emerged in this same area, like the Sabians, the star worshippers of Haran, this ancient city just on the plain below Göbekli Tepe, venerated the north and the stars of the northern sky as the place of the primal calls, the place where the souls come from and return to at death. And they celebrated this with a festival each year known as the Mystery of the North. And when I found that various other cultures in this region, particularly indigenous religions like the Yazidi, and even a local Shi'i sect known as the Brethren of Purity, also venerated the same area of the sky, I realized that this is something that could have been handed down across countless generations until it became the main thrust of the religions of these people in this region. In other words, this was something that had originally been present thousands and thousands of years earlier at sites like Göbekli Tepe.
Okay, and you have a couple of lectures you've done that are just online, and one of the things you talk about in one of them is that these T-shaped pillars were initially supposed to be people of some sort.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the lead archaeologist, Klaus Schmidt, wants to emphasize that these are not roof supports. They are statues. They are abstract statues that either represent the first gods, divinities of some kind, or they represent divine ancestors, maybe, you know, the ancestors behind, you know, the construction of the monuments themselves. And I think that this is probably correct. But what's interesting is that they don't have faces. There's a certain abstract or nebulous or etheric feel about them. When we know that this culture could carve statues with faces, they didn't do it with these pillars. They were obviously meant to be something that was removed from the real world, from the material world. In other words, they were like, you know, supernatural beings of some description. But on the other hand, I do believe that they probably represent the ancestors, the very first peoples that came and said, look, you know, let's get together and build these monuments. I do honestly believe that. You know, there may have been people that were around several hundred years, if not a thousand years, before the construction of the monuments we see today. But I think that's almost certainly what they represent.
And do you think these people may have been the Watchers, the Anunnaki, and so forth?
Yes, and I mean, this is not, you know, simply speculation. Klaus Schmidt himself, the you know, the archaeologist there, has linked the Anunnaki and the Watchers with the builders of Göbekli Tepe. And yet, obviously, as early as 1996, my book From the Ashes of Angels suggested that the Watchers and the Anunnaki were the prime movers behind the Neolithic Revolution in this very area, and that they'd come into this area from somewhere else and kick-started the whole Neolithic explosion created everything, and all of the memories of the firsts of mankind in this region, the so-called cradle of civilization, is echoed within the Book of Enoch in the stories of the Watchers and how they gave to mortal kind all the rudiments of civilization. I mean, I find that absolutely fascinating, and I am pretty certain that the Watchers are a memory of the prime movers behind the Neolithic Revolution that took place in that area. And this also is the land of Eden, the earthly paradise in this area. Here, the four rivers of paradise took their rise, just to the in the mountains to the northeast of here. And there are traditions connecting the different biblical characters associated with the Book of Genesis in the same region. Even at Haran, just below Göbekli Tepe, it was said that one of its founders was Canaan, who was the son of one of the early antediluvian patriarchs. And it was said that he uncovered a stone stela, you know, like a sort of pillar or post with writing on, that he found bore the inscriptions that had come from before the time of the flood and was the astrology and star wisdom of the Watchers themselves. And I find that really intriguing. I mean, it's a direct link with the Watchers within sight of Göbekli Tepe itself. Is it possible that this is some memory of the discovery of T-shaped pillars, either those Göbekli Tepe or those very similar to them within that same landscape?
Okay, we got to take a quick break. We'll be back in 45 seconds with Andrew Collins.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, links section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
All right, we are talking to Andrew Collins tonight on Where Did the Road Go, and you're doing a conference on all this stuff very soon, aren't you?
I am. Yes, I mean, I've just come back from Göbekli Tepe with Graham Hancock. Obviously, you know, the sort of the lead light of the Ancient Mysteries movement, and he believes that Göbekli Tepe is a game changer, that the fact that you've got these megalithic structures here that are 9,500 BC, many of them, means that we need to completely reevaluate the ages of megalithic monuments around the world. And he's going to be talking about this in a groundbreaking lecture that he's going to be giving. I mean, I've heard a proto form of it, and it really is moving. It really does tell us that something is changing, something is shifting, you know, and that we're a part of a new renaissance in this ancient mysteries movement that we're in. And this will be at Steiner House in London on November the 16th this year. Come on to andrewcollins.com for info and tickets. I mean, it's going to be an incredible event. Robert Bouvard is there, Hugh Newman, Caroline Wise, myself, and as I said, Graham Phillips. Three of the six lectures that are taking place that day will all feature Göbekli Tepe. It's that important.
Okay, now, and also people can check out some of your earlier books, From the Ashes of Angels and Gods of Eden and The Cygnus Mystery, which are all kind of precursors to your new one.
They are all precursors to Göbekli Tepe, ultimately, yeah.
Okay, now, one of the things you cited in your lecture is you compare the T-shaped pillars and the way the hands move to some of the way the hands are designed on the Easter Island statues.
That's correct, and my colleague Hugh Newman will be talking about this, because what he will be showing is that the carved art of Göbekli Tepe, uniquely, I mean, this is not something that's found all over the Near East or the ancient world, but uniquely seems to mimic a lot of the carved art found in Central and South America at places like, you know, sites in Peru, but also places like Costa Rica, where you've got those very strange bowls. There's a lot of carved art there that is in exactly the same style as that of Göbekli Tepe and Easter Island. Yeah, the huge Moai statues, they have their arms placed in a sort of right angle manner with their hands coming round to the abdomen regions, exactly the same, identical in many cases to those at Göbekli Tepe. So what possibly could be the link between these ancient cultures? Well, archaeologists would say, yes, but Easter Island statues were only created 500 or 1,000 years ago. Göbekli Tepe is at least 11,000 years old. There's absolutely no connection between the two. And yet, my colleague Robert Schock has been doing a lot of work in Easter Island, for instance, recently, and he's found good evidence to suggest that some of the Moai stretch down into the ground to levels that probably go back to 12,000 years. And if that can be verified, and also it can be shown that they actually date to this period, then they then become temporary to the villas at Göbekli Tepe.
Okay. And do you think some of these other ancient sites are going to be shown to be much older? It seems like a lot of the dating on it's pretty sketchy to start with that archaeologists use.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And as Graham Hancock will say, Göbekli Tepe is the game changer. The reason being is that its sanctuaries were covered over. They have been totally preserved, whereas most other megalithic sites around the world have not had that privilege. They've been messed about with, they've been changed, they've been moved by later cultures, and therefore the radiocarbon dating that's coming from them, plus the artifacts that are found in them, does not necessarily reflect their age of construction. And this, of course, is the excuses that the archaeologists give us all the time. Well, these monuments can't be older. We've done research there. We've done work there. They're no earlier than the Bronze Age. You know, I mean, I'm talking here about many stone circles or the Hypogeum at Malta, for instance. You know, they're all said to be no older than 2,000, 3,000, maybe 4,000 BC because it fits our paradigm of evolution, the Darwinian idea that everything began around 4,000 BC, you know, with really simple monuments that were quickly evolved into megalithic structures that eventually brought forth civilization. You know, they were rude monuments. That's what they used to call megaliths, rude monuments, because they were made by, you know, savages. And yet we now know that this is not the case. You know, we need to reevaluate the ages of many, if not all, megalithic sites around the world.
Okay. I never actually heard them called that. That's interesting.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, as far as the age of the Sphinx goes, you differ with Robert Schock on the weathering evidence, do you not?
I differ only because what Robert Schock suggested is that the weathering on the side of the enclosure at the Sphinx indicates that rain precipitation caused this weathering over a very long period of time, many thousands of years, and that the last time that there had been the amount of rain that could cause that type of weathering was perhaps 5,000, 6,000 BC, maybe earlier than that. However, work by other scholars has clearly shown that there was profuse amounts of rain during the Pharaonic period, during the, you know, all the way up to Roman times, and that there is every reason to suggest that at least part of that weathering was caused during Pharaonic times. However, having said that, I think that there is enough evidence for us to say that the Sphinx is older than the pyramid field that surrounds it. There's enough contextual evidence to suggest this. However, we don't know how old. it could be a few hundred years. That's been proposed by a British geologist, Colin Reader, with some very sensible evidence. But it could be a few thousand years old, as Robert Schock and John Anthony West suggest. We don't know, and I think that, to be honest, it's wrong to put a date on it, because there is nothing that, nothing, no evidence at all that can give us an exact date. But we should be aware of all of the possibilities here, and we should be aware that that weathering could have been caused, during dynastic times itself.
Okay, and do you think that the dating on the Great Pyramid and such is accurate?
Well, there's been two separate radiocarbon dating projects on there, which, interestingly, the results of both of them have never been published. And this I find intriguing. I mean, you can find, details of them on the net without too much problems. And the first one, gave dates in the region of around 2800 to 2900 BC. Now that's older than the time frame of Khufu, or certainly what we accept that to be, which is around 2600, 2500 BC. So that's controversial in itself. Some of the dates that were coming up with the radiocarbon date were pushing it even earlier than 3000. And because it was so controversial, they didn't publish the material and did a second one. Now, Dr. Mark Lerner was behind this, and he got the organic material that was used for it. This time there were more sensible clusters of radiocarbon dates in the region of around 2.27 to 2.8. And this was more acceptable, but it still has not been published yet. And the reason why it's not been published is because it doesn't fit exactly the paradigm. But what I will say is that there is nothing that's come out from this to suggest that the pyramids are any older than about 3000 BC, you know, like 10,000 BC. No, that's not the case. And I don't believe that that's the case. Graham Hancock doesn't believe that's the case. And most of my colleagues don't. What we do feel is possible, though, is that there was something on the site. You know, some kind of observational tower or something, where either the Great Pyramid or, perhaps more significantly, where the second pyramid was, the Pyramid of Khafre, which is at the highest point of the plateau, might mark the position of some kind of astronomical observatory of some description. That is a possibility.
Okay, and you feel the pyramids as well are aligned to Cygnus, not Orion.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I mean, and bearing in mind, as I said, my interest in Cygnus came about after I returned from Göbekli Tepe. Before that time, although it had been mentioned a few times in my life, for one reason or another, I'd never taken any significance in this constellation. But what I started to do after that was to look at monuments around the world. And what I found is that from India to Egypt to North American Hopewell culture mounds to the Incan capital of Cuzco to Olmec cities like La Venta, that Cygnus features in many of the astronomical alignments associated with these sites, or that they were actually arranged to configure with the position of Cygnus, you know, on the ground. In other words, there was some kind of ground-sky relationship. And my colleague, Rodney Hale, the engineer, was the one that actually looked at the Great Pyramids off his own back and began to realize that the match between the three Great Pyramids and Cygnus was far, far greater than that of Orion, which had been proposed by my colleague Robert Bouval, who will also be at the conference in November. In fact, if you actually take the three belt stars of Orion and try to overlay them on the three pyramids, although two obviously match, as you can obviously make that happen, whatever the case, the third star doesn't even hit the third pyramid. Now, you'd think that if the pyramid builders were building with such accuracy, as indeed they were, to do with the alignments towards true north, which is of such precision that we can hardly even match it today, you'd think that they'd get the star in the right position, or I should say the pyramid in the right position of the star. And yet, if you look further into the Cygnus relationship, not only does it have a context in the fact that the rebirth of the sun god Re and the place of birth of Osiris in the sky is associated with the region of Cygnus and the dark rift of the Milky Way, which was something that was discovered by an American astronomer named R.A. Wells in the 1970s. And he found this related totally to the pyramid texts and the funerary beliefs of ancient Egypt. So there is an absolute context for why Cygnus may have been reflected on the ground with the positions of the three pyramids. So, you know, that's very interesting indeed. And if you look, it's a no-brainer. You know, Cygnus fits, Orion doesn't. You know, how people handle that, that's up to them.
Okay, all right. And as we were talking about the Anunnaki earlier, a lot of people are probably, if they're familiar with the term, they're probably familiar with the term because of Zachariah Sitchin.
Absolutely.
And that's with the whole Nibiru and aliens and ancient aliens and so on and so forth. What context do you think that plays in your research? Do you see any evidence of these Anunnaki being ancient aliens, or do you think they're a previous culture?
I mean, the Anunnaki are the builder gods of Sumeria. Sumeria is the country that we now know as Iraq. And these builder gods were said to have helped us mortals create the first cities. Anunnaki essentially means the gods of heaven and earth. And they were said to live to the north of Sumer, or even the northeast, or sometimes even the east, within a mountain known as the Duku Mountain. It was also known as Karsag, and it was also known, the region was known as Dilmun. All of these were mythical locations that were probably all one in the same. And there is much evidence to suggest that this was a region within the Zagros Mountains, or the Taurus Mountains, to the north or northeast of Iraq. And this is the precise area of Göbekli Tepe and the site of the Garden of Eden in biblical tradition. So to look in this region for answers to do with the Anunnaki makes sense. To find that Klaus Schmidt, the archaeologist at Göbekli Tepe, has also linked the Duku Mound with Göbekli Tepe and the builders of Göbekli Tepe with the Anunnaki seems to suggest that we are definitely talking about the memory of some kind of elite, maybe shamans, maybe some kind of ruling dynasty, prime movers behind the construction of these monuments who gave us the rudiments of civilization, if you like. So now transferring this knowledge into the theories of Zachariah Sitchin and the idea that the Anunnaki and the Watchers are spacemen who came down from the stars 200,000 years ago, made humans, stole all our gold and took it off world, to me it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I'm sorry. You know, to some people this may be a cherished belief, and if that's the case, then good luck to you. But for me, it doesn't work at all. I'm sorry.
All right. Do you think there's a connection between the Anunnaki and these elongated skulls we're finding around the world?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that it would seem that the myths that were handed down, even during the Neolithic, relating to the prime movers, the founders of the early Neolithic, i.e. the Göbekli builders, were that they were extremely tall, they had long faces, you know, just like the Watchers of the Book of Enoch, and that they looked special, they looked different to the other people in the area. And if they were the Watchers were said to have had visages, i.e. faces, like vipers. they are described as like walking serpents. As I say, they're very tall as well. And I did From the Ashes of Angels back in 1996. I worked out that you're looking for somebody who was extremely tall, elongated heads, elongated faces. And this doesn't describe the people of the ancient world of the Near East, essentially. Not around 9000 BC, at least. And I worked out that they must have come from somewhere else. Now, at that time, I suggested that they probably came from Egypt, you know, and were maybe connected with some kind of lost civilization there. Now, however many years later, I mean, how many is it, 16 years later or more, 17, I've realized that that is probably a naive way of looking at things, and that these prime movers probably came from another part of the ancient world. Certainly there were people from Egypt, I think, in the area where Göbekli was being constructed, and they may well have had some kind of influence on what was going on. But I'm pretty certain that the prime movers behind Göbekli Tepe were coming from another part of the ancient world. And I'm going to reveal where at the Origins 2013 conference in November. So what I will say is it's certainly not Egypt.
Okay. And now you're talking about the alignments on Göbekli Tepe. Do you believe there ever could have been a pole shift of any kind that would have affected those alignments?
There's nothing at the moment that would suggest anything to do with a pole shift. And I mean, a pole shift is a very, very dramatic thing. And what I mean by that is that when we had the tsunami, the South Asian tsunami back in, what was it, 2000 and, oh, I can't remember, well, a few years ago, I can't remember the exact year
right.
now. There was a very, very, very slight shift in the pole. I mean, it was, you know, just a few millionth of a degree, but it did actually take place. So that suggests that these can occur. And quite clearly, if you've got a comet smacking into the Earth, it's going to have much more of an effect. So there was probably a very slight shift at that time. And then we're talking about 12,900 years ago. That'd be 10,900 BC. That's the date that scientists are looking at now. However, there doesn't appear to be any major evidence of a pole shift around the time of Göbekli Tepe or since that time, no. No, I mean,
okay.
If there was, I would tell you.
And around that same region in From the Ashes of Angels, you talk about Cappadocia, is that how you say it?
Yeah, that's just to the west of this region.
And that absolutely fascinated me when I read your book, because, I mean, this is a full underground city and no one really knows where it came from,
well,
do they?
It's more than that. I mean, there's possibly up to 20, 30 underground cities all in the same area. Some of them are supposedly linked by tunnels that stretch for many miles. And it's estimated that up to 20,000 people could have lived in these cities. And I was there recently, as I said, I was there with Graham Hancock at Göbekli Tepe. We also visited the underground cities, and Graham and I were of the same opinion. And that was the fact that almost certainly these were not places people lived for any length of time. For the most simple reason, and that's sanitation. If you had 20,000 people living underground with the only means of access being these deep wells that are sunken down that also act as air shafts, people, you know, urinating and defecating every day, 20,000 people, what the hell are you going to do with that? That stuff. I mean, that in itself almost makes it a nonsense that these were places where people live for any extended period of time. What seems to be more likely is that people either were there for a very brief period of time, days at the most, or that they were used for visionary experiences, very much like the Hypogeum in Malta, or various other cave-like environments that have been used since Paleolithic times for shamanic purposes. That seems to be much more likely. That's not to say that people didn't slay down them at times or enhance them at certain periods, but that was not the great purpose for people to live inside them. As to their age, there is some evidence that suggests that they may go back to Paleolithic times. So they could have been around at the time when the comet impact occurred. So it's possible that people could have gone in there on a very temporary basis and stayed there and come out and then gone back there and whatever. But I don't believe that anybody could have been in there and stayed in there for any length of time.
Hmm. Okay. But it could have potentially been used while Earth changes were occurring.
It could have done, yeah. But there would have had to have been regular access to the surface as well.
Hmm. Okay. Now, Göbekli Tepe, I mean, obviously, we know the age of it. Do you think any of the other structures that haven't been uncovered will be found to be older?
Well, Klaus Schmidt expects that there will be earlier monuments going back at least another 2,000 years. But he sees them as being primitive and evolving to the beautiful, incredible enclosures that we see today that were constructed around 9,500 BC. In other words, he thinks that there was some kind of period of evolution. Now, I don't believe that he will find those. I think that the earliest monuments were the most magnificent. I don't think there was any period. There might be some very primitive structures there. I mean, because it may have been a sacred place before these monuments were created. But you're not going to see an evolution. I think that these are using technology that probably came from a lost civilization.
Do you think we're going to find any other Göbekli Tepes out there?
Well, there is. There is something else that's rising in importance at this time. And I cannot pronounce it now, so I will not use the actual term. I think it's Gunung Padang, which is a site in Indonesia, which is on the top of a natural mountain, or some suggest it might be man-made, which is a series of basaltic pillars. I mean, literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them that formed these terraces and structures, these stone circles, if you like, which recent evaluation by a geological team that's been working there for the last 5 years has obtained radiocarbon dating of the soil beneath them, suggesting that there was activity going on there and construction between 9 and 20,000 years ago. And this is extraordinary if that's the case. I mean, exactly how this fits together, nobody quite knows at the moment. And they're not saying necessarily that the stone circles on the top have been there for 9,000 years or more. However, it does seem as if what we see today was built on the top of earlier structures that could be equally as impressive. And I think you will find more monuments like this around the world. They're gradually coming to light, and the chances are we already have them in exactly the same way that the first team that looked at Göbekli Tepe thought that the carvings looked so sophisticated that they could be no more than 1,000 years old, suggests that there's many more monuments around the world that we've misinterpreted the age of, simply because we don't expect them to be as old as what they really are. I genuinely believe that is the case. And I think that we're in for an incredible time now over the next 10 to 20 years of discovery as we reevaluate all of this evidence that has told us that this paradigm insists that everything has to have been constructed from 4000 BC onwards to the present day. That has now been completely destroyed, and the field is once open again to any new ideas, and that's what's so exciting.
What are your thoughts on the Bosnian pyramid?
I'm not impressed by what I've seen of the Bosnian pyramids, I'm afraid. I have had conversations with Sam Osganovic, the lead historian working on the site, and I've voiced my opinions to him, and he accepts them. But in my opinion, this is a natural feature of the landscape, and that what they're uncovering And what they're presenting as archaeological evidence is nothing of the sort. And that the tunnels that they've discovered nearby, not within the mountains themselves, have no real connection with these natural structures, which are simply hills or mountains, if you like. And that I'm very unimpressed with what I see. And I can tell you now that you will not see mention of the Bosnian pyramids in any of my books.
Okay. All right. Your conference is when?
It's November the 16th. If you're interested in coming to London for this, then go on to andrewcollins.com or onto megalithomania.co.uk. That's my partner, Hugh Newman's site. We're working together on this one. And tickets are still available. It will sell out, I'm pretty certain of that, but there are still tickets available now. And as I said, you can hear myself, Graham Hancock, Robert Bouval, Graham Phillips, Hugh Newman, Caroline Wise on the Saturday, and on the Sunday there's a London walkabout of the historical sites that I'm doing myself. And it'll be, I think it'll be a monumental weekend. So hopefully see some of you there.
All right, and the new book will be out, do you know when next year?
It's just the early part of next year, so, you know, in the spring of next year. And as I say, that's called Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods.
And if people want to check out any related stuff that you've already written, they could check out the Cygnus Mystery, Gods of Eden.
Well, Eden. I would do it in order. I would first look at From the Ashes of Angels.
Yes.
Because that
yes.
was being written as the first spades were being put down at Göbekli Tepe, you know, and you know, in other words, when Klaus Schmidt was looking at Göbekli Tepe for the first time, I was writing From the Ashes of Angels without any knowledge of that site. So that's quite weird synchronicities. Then move on to the Cygnus Mystery. If you're interested in the whole cataclysm, I wrote about that in Gateway to Atlantis in 2000. Mm-hmm. But now it's being verified by science.
All right. And you also wrote a book on Tutankhamun, too.
I did indeed, yes, with co-authored with Chris Ogilvy Herald, called Tutankhamun, The Exodus Conspiracy, and, you know, various other books I've written. In fact, I think I've written about 14 now, so, and I'm still doing it for my sins.
You're re-releasing one of your old ones, right?
I am, yeah. Don't get me onto that tonight. That's The Black Alchemist. That was the thing that put me where I needed to be back in 1988, 89. It became a bestseller overnight. It's basically a cult classic. I can talk to you about that when it's re-released.
Okay, awesome. The Last Exit for the Lost is up next, and that the name of that show, which I also host, comes from Fields of the Nephilim, and Carl McCoy, the vocalist, has a connection to you, doesn't he?
He does, indeed. I mean, I've known Carl for 20, 25 years. We've worked together on many projects, he actually designed, or his company, Sheer Faith, designed the cover for, or the covers of two of my books, Beneath the Pyramids and also 21st Century Grail. You know, we help each other, basically.
We can end with a song by Fields if you have a pick.
Whale of Sumer.
Whale of Sumer, that's very appropriate. All right, thank you, Andrew. Hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
My pleasure. Thank you.